This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The Hidden Psychology of Pain, The Use of Understanding to Heal Chronic Pain. And the author is Dr. James Alexander. And Dr. Alexander joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Dr. Alexander.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
Great to have you with us all the way from Australia. Let me read some about your book so we can expand on the title. You say this, people can overcome chronic pain, as it is not the untreatable blight on modern life which the pain industry has led us to believe. In order to overcome chronic pain, sufferers need to delve into its causes in the form of psychological dilemmas, emotional distress, and other repressed unconscious material. Much more than physical. We always think, well, we take this pill and, you know, we get rid of it. Well, of course, we never get rid of it. It just kind of takes it away for a moment or longer. But you're talking about pain that just is always there, just never goes away.
That's correct. We need to distinguish between acute pain and chronic pain. And acute pain is the sort of pain that we feel after we've undergone an injury. So if we fall over, bang our knee or twist our ankle, then that's an acute pain. And the body generally takes anywhere between a couple of weeks through to 3 months to do the repair work required to fix that kind of pain, whether we're talking about soft tissue injury or even hard tissue injury. Whereas chronic pain is the kind of pain that lasts by definition for more than 3 months, and it can last for decades for people, and it just seems to never go away. So it's often called persistent pain. So that's the first point that we need to make, that there's a very big difference between acute pain and chronic pain. My book is addressing chronic pain, not acute pain.
Now, you experienced chronic pain for how long before you figured out how to get rid of it?
I experienced chronic pain myself for around 18 years, and I didn't get rid of that till I was in my late 30s.
So what was that situation or the pain? What was it coming from?
Well, I was nearly killed in a car accident when I was 18 years old. I was hit in a head-on car accident by a drunk driver, and I was driving a van. And the whole thing collapsed in on my legs, and I was trapped in the car for 2.5 hours with bones sticking out of my body everywhere, and basically bleeding to death. Well, not quite to death, obviously, but bleeding profusely for apparently 2.5 hours before they could cut me out. And as you'd expect, that was quite a traumatizing experience, both physically and emotionally. When I physically recovered from that, probably took around a year to physically recover, it wasn't long afterwards I developed an extreme pain in the left groin. It felt like a permanently torn groin muscle. And that pain stayed with me for the next 18 years. And as I said before, it wasn't until I was in my late 30s that I finally worked out what was going on with that. And during those 18 years, I tried a whole range of different physical therapies. I consulted with physiotherapists and chiropractors, and they each had their own theories as to what was causing the pain. They usually related it to what they presumed to be physical damage to my spine that I must have incurred in the head-on car accident. They suggested that my spine had been damaged in some way and it was impacting on a nerve and shooting a referred pain into my groin. And so they tried a range of interventions that usually involved some kind of traction to pull the vertebra further apart. And, you know, a range of different kind of physical manipulations on my spine. The reality is that, unfortunately, none of those interventions worked at all. It wasn't unusual for me to find relief when I was receiving the treatment, but getting into my car in the therapist's car park, often the pain would come back. This is something like 5 minutes after I'd completed the treatment. And I experienced that pain for 18 years. Nothing really got rid of it. Occasionally, I could work out things that would help to ameliorate it a bit, but nothing actually ever got rid of the pain. Until I came across the idea that unconscious emotional or psychological factors can actually play a very large role in maintaining this kind of chronic pain over a long period of time.
So in your case, what psychological factor kept that pain just remaining with you?
Well, I was lucky enough to have a fairly blessed childhood, so I wasn't suffering from any traumas from childhood or my adolescence. However, of course, the fact that I was nearly killed in a traumatic car accident when I was 18 was a very significant factor. I remember when they wheeled me into the emergency department of a hospital after freeing me from the car wreck. When I was 18 years old, and there was a bunch of medical people buzzing around me, cutting off items of clothing, lifting limbs, assessing the damage. At that point, I put a lid on my distress. I remember starting to cry, and I noticed that quite a few of the medical staff around me were attractive young nurses, and I became embarrassed. And I put a lid on my distress, and I stopped myself from crying. And really, that was the way that I coped with the injury, with the whole trauma for many years, basically by putting a lid on it and pretending that the trauma wasn't there. And I think the effect of that really was to force it underground, you know, mm-hmm. basically force it into a fairly deep unconscious level. And I proceeded to get on with my life, which was highly desirable. I didn't want to remain a victim for my whole life. And I decided as a result of my accident that I wanted to become a psychologist so I could help other people that had been traumatized by bad experiences like what I'd experienced. And I went ahead and went to university, did the study and the training required, became a psychologist. So my desire to get on with life and to not be a perpetual victim, I think, was a very positive thing. However, the only way that I could really do that was by forcing the trauma underground or down to a very deep unconscious level, whereby I guess you could say I repressed it, I denied the trauma. It was almost like it was a bad movie that I remembered seeing from many years ago. And, of course, what happened to me was that I spent the next 18 years living with chronic pain in my left groin. And it wasn't until, as I said before, I was in the late 30s that I came across the idea that unconscious emotional psychological distress, so upset which is occurring at a very deep level, much deeper for us to be consciously aware of, can actually be triggering and maintaining chronic pain. And for me, the obvious candidate in this was the trauma that I'd experienced as an 18-year-old, which I'd largely turned my back on and tried to pretend had not happened. And as I said, it had positive results in that it allowed me to get on with my life. However, I do think there was a cost attached to that strategy, and I think that cost was that I experienced 18 years of living with chronic pain. Now, I know that this is what my chronic pain was about, as when I was 38, I came across this notion that psychological factors could contribute to chronic pain by a book called Spontaneous Healing, written by a physician named Andrew Weil. And in that book, he made reference to this possibility that psychological factors could be contributing to chronic pain. And I sort of investigated that idea further, and having a background in research, I started looking into this notion, and I managed to find quite a lot of literature, historical literature, in regards to this possibility. And the most recent of which was a professor of rehabilitation medicine at New York University Hospital by the name of Professor John Sarno. And I came across the books written by Professor Sarno, and I discovered that he had in turn picked up these ideas from a Hungarian psychoanalyst called Franz Alexander, no relation to me as far as I know, who became the chair of psychosomatic medicine at Chicago University in the late 1930s. And Professor Franz Alexander was working a lot with chronic illness and looking at psychological factors in chronic illness, not so much chronic pain, but more so with illness. Now, Franz Alexander had derived his ideas originally from the originator of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud. And, of course, we can even trace Freud's ideas going back further, the whole notion of there being an unconscious mind as a storehouse of the emotional flavour of all of our experiences goes right back, probably as far back as to the ancient Greeks and more than likely back to the indigenous cultures of Europe and many other parts of the world as well. So these ideas have been in our culture for a great deal of time, maybe forever. And when I started looking into this, I found that there's a great legacy of these ideas. And I started working with them, started really immersing myself in this possibility that unconscious psychological factors could have a role to play in the causation of my chronic pain. And the real proof for me came when I was in my late 30s, I decided I was taking my family for a holiday with our children, and we were going back to the part of Australia where my car accident had happened to me as an 18-year-old, and I hadn't been back there since. And as it turned out, just purely by coincidence, it turned out to be we were going to be visiting the same place, the same area, on the anniversary date of my car accident, many years later, of course, in fact, 20 years later. And my children wanted to see the place where the accident had happened, and so I was going to take them to the accident site 20 years later, but it turned out that it was going to be actually on the anniversary date, which is purely a fluke. What sort of twigged me to this possibility was that for about a week before we arrived at the accident site, the pain in my groin became the most intense I'd ever experienced in the previous 20 years. It was so bad that I could barely walk, and I felt like I was simply dragging my left leg behind me. I was highly disabled, and it was the worst that I'd ever experienced it. When I was at the accident site, showing my family where the accident happened, and the place where I hadn't died, the penny finally dropped for me that this is no coincidence that the pain was at its most intense. I kind of at that point realised it was the anniversary of the accident. Mm-hmm. I was in the same part of the world, the same time of the year, the place where the most significant trauma I'd ever experienced had happened. And all of a sudden it became undeniable to me. The penny dropped. It became readily apparent that my physical pain was really just a physical manifestation of the emotional trauma that I'd experienced as an 18-year-old. And over the course of the next week, my pain gradually, bit by bit, went away. And I've never had it since. And that was about 12 years ago.
So the subconscious was literally like experiencing the accident all again at that moment.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Well, you know, it makes so much sense, even to a layman like myself. I've interviewed authors who have been sexually abused as a child. I've interviewed soldiers who, of course, have gone through the horror of war. And they bring that pain, well, they hold on to that pain throughout their lives, and it can disrupt them totally. And it's an emotional, psychological barrier.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I think that one of the things is that we both America and Australia, share a culture of being resilient and being optimistic and being positive. And I think that's a wonderful thing, and that's certainly what allowed me to get on with my life after I'd experienced my accident. And no doubt a lot of the soldiers in both America and Australia are much the same. So I don't want to suggest there's something wrong with wanting to get on with life. It's a really positive thing. However, I do think that it comes at a cost, and often when people have been highly traumatised, they do need to try to push the trauma away so that they can just face another day and keep on facing another day. But there is often a cost attached to pushing that trauma away. And the more that we do that, the more unconscious it becomes. We repress it and suppress it and force it down into an unconscious level. Now, just because we do that doesn't mean that the trauma actually disappears. It might disappear from our conscious awareness so we can focus on what we need to focus on to get on with life. But the act of suppressing trauma doesn't actually make it go away. And I think trauma is ubiquitous in our society. I think most people in varying degrees are carrying levels of trauma. There are the more obvious cases of trauma where people have been seriously violated in their childhood or teenage years or car accidents or war experiences and natural disasters. And then I think there's a whole lot of less obvious traumas that are basically part of our common experience.
Doctor, we have a couple minutes left. I want you to tell us how your book will help us get rid of the chronic pain.
Okay, well, the most important thing for overcoming chronic pain is information. And information really is power. We've been fooled to believe that chronic pain, as opposed to acute pain, we've been fooled to believe that chronic pain results from the biomechanics of our body going awry. And there's an enormous amount of research evidence which clearly demonstrates that this is not the case. However, as a culture, we've been fooled into believing there's something wrong with our body which produces chronic pain. The reality is that this is simply not true. Something else must be producing chronic pain, because a lot of the research suggests that it simply isn't faulty biomechanics of the body. When people become aware of emotional, hidden emotional and psychological factors which can produce chronic pain, then knowledge is power. And simply having that level of awareness, as I explained with my experience, having that level of awareness that there are emotional factors that are behind and producing chronic pain is often enough to help people to embark on a self-help process where they can begin to bring greater awareness within themselves around what could be producing their chronic pain, what aspects of their own personal backgrounds and lives could be producing that. And my experience of introducing these ideas to an enormous amount of people in the last 12 or so years has been that a great many people are also able to overcome their chronic pain through an increased awareness of what the psychological factors are that could be producing it. Everybody's different. Everybody's going to have different psychological factors.
Right.
So it's not a cookbook, but my book is essentially a self-help book which provides a lot of information to people. It dispels a lot of myths about what can be producing chronic pain. It presents good, accurate information about what are the likely causes of chronic pain in terms of psychological factors. And it takes people through a self-analysis process whereby they can answer a range of questions which I've built into the book, which will help people to review their own childhood experience and their adolescence experiences, get a sense of what could be their psychological factors which relate to their own personal pain, and help people to then work through those experiences. It's essentially a self-help process, and because this is essentially based on information, people are very able to process and digest information for themselves. Now, there are times when information alone is not sufficient to do this. This is where people may be carrying significant trauma from extremely bad experiences. And I have quite a bit of information in the book about the best type of psychological approaches that can help people to overcome extreme trauma, which may be producing their chronic pain.
Well, Dr. Alexander, one of your reviewers says the book is easy to read and would be a benefit to professionals as well as to clients and patients, and then gives a testimony. I personally tried the techniques to manage arthritic back pain and found that they work. So you can't get any better than that. Dr. Alexander, tell us how to get your book, The Hidden Psychology of Pain.
Well, at the moment, you can get it through either of two websites. You can get it through my personal website, which is www.drjamesalexander-psychologist.com, or you can get it through www.thehiddenpsychologyofpain.com.
Thank you so much, Dr. Alexander, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you, Steve.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready to live La Bella Vita with Dawn Catherine on TogiNet.com. Live La Bella Vita. If you're wanting to know all the beauty tricks of the trade and the latest fashion trends before everyone else, this is your show. If you admire celebrities' beauty and their fashion sense, this is your show. Do you love wine and want to know more about the process it takes to make wine from the vine to the bottle? This is your show. Live La Bella Vita. For more on the show and your host, check out our website, labellavitacosmetico.com. This is the kind of show you can sink your teeth into. If you enjoy traveling and food and family, all with an Italian flair, then you can live La Bella Vita with your host, Dawn Catherine. Wednesday nights at midnight, 11 p.m. Central, on TogiNet.com. Mark Lipinski is coming to TogiNet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, a live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Froth and Goblets, and the author is Ted Scott. And Ted joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Ted.
Hello, Steve.
Great to have you with us all the way from Australia. This is a parable, an extended parable, as you call it, and we'll find out why it's a parable in a moment and get into the details of the characters and the teachings that are in this great story. Let me read what you've written about your book. This book is intended to be an interesting work of fiction, but it is underpinned by considerable research on psychology. It is a story about a princess with depression and offers some suggestions about how those with depression might improve their lots. It is my hope that it not only offers some useful suggestion to those with depression, but it's an engaging enough story in its own right to interest readers. So that's the key here, is to create this parable, entertainment, at the same time teaching. That's the goal, and of course you have accomplished it very well.
Oh, thank you, Steve. Well, that's certainly what I had in mind.
Well, tell us about yourself, Ted, how you got involved in all this and why you wrote this great story.
Oh, well, Steve, how should I start? I guess I'm an ex-executive. I was an executive in the electricity industry for many years. About 10 or 12 years ago, I resigned from my position as a CEO of a large electricity utility to go into consulting. And a lot of the work I've done as a consultant has really been as an executive coach, where I do one-on-one work with executives to improve their functioning, I guess. And I suppose that just reflects my interest in people. When I thought back about my career, the most satisfaction I got as an executive was actually helping the people that work for me develop and prosper. So I decided once I left the role as an executive, coaching would enable me to do the same thing in a different way. Now, I've published quite a number of books. This is my fourth. The first book I published was in conjunction with my good colleague, Dr. Phil Harker, and it was called Humanity at Work, which is a book about leadership and organisations. My second book was called Augustus Finds Serenity. It was a book of 30 odd short parables, which sort of each was a little teaching vignette in its own right with some commentaries. And my third book was called You, the Dragon Tamer, which was a story about a man with a mental illness and how that was ameliorated, again with the help of my principal character, Augustus. And Augustus, of course, appears in this fourth book as the protagonist that helps Naomi relieve her symptoms of depression. So there's a continuity of thread there in the last three books that I've written. They all have some basis on Buddhism. I'm not a Buddhist myself. I'm a fellow traveler with Buddhism. I believe Buddhism is more a psychology than religion, and I think it has some good lessons for us all. Now, I've had instances in my life of family members that have suffered depression. I've had to coach people with depression, and I've known quite a few people with depression. So it has touched me in that regard, and as a result, I thought I'd like to learn a little bit more about it. And it's an emerging problem, as you know. I think I've read something to the effect that the World Health Organization predicted by 2020 that depression will be the second most significant health issue in the world after heart disease. So it's a growing problem, and one that causes great debilitation for those who suffer. So that's how I got to be where I am at, and that this final book, not my final book, my latest book, has been written with that premise in mind. Let's try and help people with depression and those around them. And as I've said on many occasions, I think that a lot of the greatest truths that mankind have come to know have been related and learnt by the use of parable and metaphor. And that's why I've tried to use that medium again to get this particular message across.
Well, let's talk about Princess Naomi. She's the daughter of a sultan. And of course, you think a daughter of a sultan would just be a life of bliss and joy and happiness, but she's got a darker side. Tell us about Naomi.
Yeah, well, Naomi has depression. It wasn't immediately apparent. And when she was a little girl, she was a serious little girl. And from her accounts, it sounds as though her mother must have suffered a similar problem. But her mother died quite early in her life, in Naomi's life, and she has been brought up by her father, the Sultan. Initially, she was a very precocious young girl, and when the Sultan had guests at the palace, she would often come to dinners and be invited to entertain the guests. She was a good conversationalist and used to play music. But in later years, the depression set in. By the time Augustus finds her, she is now very withdrawn, has given up the music, spends a lot of time in her chamber, isolated from people, often weeping, and she's manifesting the general symptoms of depression.
And folks who deal with depression, is it just a personal attack on themselves all the time, some kind of real abusive self-talk? Is that what this vicious cycle is?
Yeah, that's a fair enough explanation, Steve. People with depression, as I've often said, are somewhat self-absorbed, but not in a narcissistic kind of way. They have these bad thoughts and they can't let them go. So they become obsessed with them. And whilst a lot of minor mental issues are helped by having people you can talk to about them, sometimes in depression this doesn't help because it actually encourages more focus on those symptoms and you get into this phenomenon which is called rumination. And that becomes a downward spiraling event where people saps the energy out of them and they become more and more melancholic. And that's really the problem. I think Dorothy Rowe, who's one of my favourite authors on depression, said that depressed people had a particular worldview. And this is how she described it. She said, depressed people feel that no matter how good and acceptable I appear to be, I am really bad, evil, valueless, unacceptable to myself and other people. Other people are such that I must fear, hate, and envy them. Life is terrible and death is worse. Only bad things have happened to me in the past and only bad things will happen to me in the future. I must never forgive anyone, least of all myself. So you could understand a person who sees the world through that sort of a lens is in a very bad place indeed.
Drugs are often used to counter that. In this case, the Sultan thinks he's going to help her with those kinds of drugs that exist in this far-off land?
Oh, that's true. The Sultan tried a couple of different things. He had the physician look at Naomi with no visible problems with her physically. He then had Naomi attended to by his apothecary, who subscribed a potion that he mixed, and that had no long-term benefit either. And finally, he sent for a dervish that one of his court members had recognized as useful in these matters in the past. And he came and did his thing, but to no avail.
But finally, Augustus, a Buddhist master, is summoned, and there seems to be hope.
Yes, indeed. Augustus was introduced to the Sultan by one of his northern regional chieftains, and Augustus had a reputation of being helpful in the village where he was at and helped people with a number of issues. And they prevailed on Augustus to go to the palace to help Naomi with her problem. And I guess Augustus' approach was a bit surprising in the first instance, because he said he wouldn't treat the princess unless he was given at least 6 months to work with her. Whereas I suppose in the past, the Sultan and the people around her were looking for the miracle cure that was going to happen in 5 minutes. But Augustus knew that depression is really all about human behaviour, and you don't change human behaviour in 5 minutes. So it was going to take a reasonably long time to get her to change that worldview to something a bit more productive and useful. So he set out about doing a number of things, and the techniques that he used come both from the Buddhist tradition, but also I've interwoven there some of the modern findings of positive psychology that is promoted by such people as Dr. Martin Seligman and Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who's a Czechoslovakian psychologist. Anyhow, so Augustus's first approach was to teach Naomi meditation, because meditation helps you silence the self-talk in the mind, and that gives you a breathing space where you're not continually denigrating yourself as most people with depression do. After she became adept at that, he encouraged her to take up her flute. Someone says that we have a particular signature strength. These are the things that we do, we like to do, we like to be stretched in them. And if we can utilize our signature strengths, not only is that pleasurable, but it actually helps build our psychological robustness. Yourself, the days when you're doing something that you're engaged in and you're enjoying, and you look up and you think, well, it's lunchtime already, where's the day gone? Csikszentmihalyi wrote a book that he called Flow, which is really about that state. When you get into the state where you've looked out the rest of the world, you're concentrating on what you're doing, you're enjoying it, and that improves your psychological robustness. The final technique that he used was to utilize her underlying compassion. She, from her history, Augustus was able to determine that she had been a compassionate person. And he found a way for her to go out and help the poor in the city of Yolampur, where the palace was located. And that was helpful also, because altruism has many benefits. The Dalai Lama says, if you want to make people happy, other people happy, be compassionate. He then says, if you want to be happy, well, be compassionate, because that flows back into your own well-being. And I've mentioned in the past that one of the underlying principles that I've used over the years is taken from my good friend Dr. Phil Harker, and he says the way to psychological robustness is that first you have to know yourself, then hopefully get to accept yourself, and then finally, if possible, to forget yourself. And when your concerns are about others rather than yourself, well, that's that process of forgetting yourself, and that also helps to break that downward spiral of rumination that people with depression go through. So they were the three main techniques, and that's supported by the work of Seligman and others. He used other things as well. One other technique was about positive reinforcement. One of the problems that you find with depressed people is that when they get very sad, melancholic, then people give them a lot of attention. And that tends to reinforce that behavior. Augustus was keen to make sure that those people around Naomi gave her lots of positive reinforcement when she was in a positive frame of mind. And of course, the thing that she desired most was her father's company. So he made sure that when she was in a positive frame of mind, he spent a lot of time with her. The other problem with people that are depressed, they can't often see the good things that happen to them. And Augusta started a process with Naomi that every day when they went through their practice sessions, he would ask her to name three good things that had happened to her. And of course, she initially resisted that and saying, you know, that Augustus, you don't understand, there's nothing good that ever happens to me. But after a while, he was able to wheedle out of her that there were some good things that happened to her. You know, her handmaid would bring her a bunch of flowers, or she found a puppy to cuddle, or her father had given her some attention, and they were all nice things. So he kept reinforcing that despite the fact that you're in this dark place, well, because of the fact you're in this dark place, you often overlook the good things that are going on around you. So he tried to reinforce that as well.
Well, what a great parable to help us best deal with depression. It may not cure it, but it certainly can help manage it and give a person a productive life, as in the princess, this great parable. Well, Ted, tell us how to get your book, Froth and Goblets.
Well, you can get it from the publisher, which is Balboa Press, and it's also available as an ebook on Amazon. They're probably the two simplest ways to acquire a copy.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Well, thank you, Steve. I enjoyed talking with you.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready to laugh along with This Little Parent Stayed Home with Ali Lopreet. Friday evenings at 6, 5 Central on TogiNet.com. This is a truly realistic, no-nonsense, tell-it-like-it-is method that will have you laughing and crying, surviving while struggling, and hammering away at the hardships as you travel through the greatest journey of your life. Get empowered by joining thousands of other parents who have also decided to take a leap of faith into a double career with longer hours and half the pay simply because of the love they have for their children. Together, we are rebuilding a new economy that will support us rather than enslave us. Never again will we have to choose between raising our children and earning to provide for them. It won't be easy, but it will be worth it. For more on Allie and her success, check out her website, OurMilkMoney.com. So come get empowered with This Little Parent Stayed Home with Allie Lopreet, Friday afternoons at 6, 5 Central on TogiNet.com.
People think I've made it. I'm popular. I seem happy all the time. I have great clothes and I'm involved in everything. But I have questions, doubts, and fears, just like every other teenager. That's why I'm glad for Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 Central on TogiNet.com.
The choices we have to make that can alter the course of our lives. Life is too much pressure if we try to go it alone. I tune in to Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell every week to get reminded that I'm not alone. Nicole Odell is an expert on what happens in the lives of teenagers. Join her as she deals with topics like peer pressure, purity, drugs, alcohol, and many other things that might come up along the way. She writes books and speaks to people all over the place, but she says her favorite moments are when she can pull up a chair and chat with teens about what's important to us.
For more information on Nicole and her books, go to NicoleOdell.com. Then join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 Central on TogiNet.com.
Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Beyond the Ego, Where Love and Joy and Peace of Mind Await You. And the author is David Mutchler. And Dr. Mutchler joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Dr. Mutchler.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us. Let me read a little about your professional background and some of your this journey that you've been on to help us better understand the ego. This is what you say Dr. David Mutchler is a pioneer in the field of spiritual transformation. Widely read in the matters of the spirit, over the years he began to notice that much of his own spirituality was limited to head knowledge. Though he could cite many authors on a variety of spiritual subjects, his own personal challenges made him realize that he was not experiencing the peace and joy as fully in his heart as he was able to conceptualize in his thoughts. It was after having read A New Earth that David began asking the question, how does one move spiritual wisdom from head to heart so as to fully experience peace, joy, and love in oneself and toward others? And in discussions with seekers from various spiritual practices, he discovered these were common questions on their minds as well. And subsequently, he embarked on an intense journey inward to discover the answers to these gnawing questions. The result of that journey is a pathway to peace, from which David has written 4 books, developed a highly sought-after experiential workshop called Awaken to Ego, Discover Your Spirit. David has earned degrees in education, philosophy, psychology, and social work, and conducted advanced studies in religion. He has brought his various studies and life experiences together in a unique perspective that has relevance to all who seek spiritual transformation. 2 of the trademarks of David's work are his insistence on the simplification of concepts that are typically thought to be both complex and esoteric, and his how-to approach to helping people assimilate and apply those concepts to bring more peace into their lives. David now devotes the majority of his time to writing, speaking, and leading weekend intensives as a spiritual teacher and guide. Well, you certainly have quite a lot of experiences as an author and as a teacher, David. Why don't you tell us more about your motivation to write these 4 books and develop the Awaken to Ego program?
Well, Steve, I've been deeply interested in spiritual subjects my entire adult life, and I've read extensively on the subject, attended seminars, participated in discussion groups, meditated, all the usual stuff. But, you know, I still wasn't finding the peace inside that I had been in search of for many, many years, and which I so dearly wanted. As I became more and more familiar with Eckhart Tolle's work, I was particularly gripped by his book, A New Earth, and his emphasis on becoming more conscious of your ego and its destructive nature. After studying the book repeatedly, I felt called to take his concepts about what needed to be done, which he wrote so clearly and extensively about, to another level by exploring in more depth how to do it. As a result of a very personal and in-depth search for the answers, I've written 4 books on how to do it, how to transform yourself spiritually, how to move it from your head to your heart, how to bring it down to earth so you can live it and breathe it on a daily basis. And in addition, I've developed a popular and fast-growing weekend intensive workshop called Awaken to Ego, Discover Your Spirit, which now is mostly abbreviated to Awaken to Ego, an experiential step-by-step journey, again, on how to do what Eckhart Tolle, Deepak Chopra, and so many other spiritual icons have prescribed.
Is each of your books written in the same genre, or are they about different subjects?
You know, Steve, it's like trying to describe a mountain. You can view it from different angles, and each view looks different, but it's still the same mountain. So, yes, the 4 books are about the same subject, but they are written from 4 different perspectives. Different angles appeal to different people, yet taken as a whole, they most fully define the heart of my work, which is the Awakened Ego perspective.
Well, David Mutchler, please tell us briefly about each of your books.
Okay, the first book was Beyond the Ego, which helps you understand what ego is. There's much confusion about that, by the way. How and why it causes us dissatisfaction and suffering, why we all have one, the many places it hides, how to identify it at work inside us, and how to rid ourselves of ego once we learn to identify its subtle and insidious presence in our lives. Beyond the Ego puts in simple language that the secret to finding joy, love, and peace is to loosen ourselves from ego's painful grip by going beyond the ego and entering the world of spirit. Ego is like a huge storm cloud, if you will, that blocks the light of spirit from shining through. And only when ego shrinks away can we begin to enjoy the light and therefore the gifts of spirit. For ego to fade away, we must travel through the ego. We can't go around it, fight it, or try to crush it or destroy it. The second book, Lessons for Living Beyond the Ego, takes into consideration that growing beyond your ego to achieve happiness, love, and peace of mind is a journey, not a one-time event. Your ego has been with you since you were first given a name. When you identify and observe ego inside yourself, it shrivels up and dies, but it takes time to become conscious of the many nuances of ego so that one by one you can rid yourself of them. So Lessons for Living Beyond the Ego is a collection of 52 lessons to help you identify ego at work in your life so you can move steadily forward on your journey from ego to spirit. Book number 3 is Non-Judgment Day is Coming. Are you ready? One of ego's favorite hiding places is in our judgments, where it causes a lot of problems, broken or damaged relationships, misunderstandings, and even war, to name only a few. So to rid ourselves of ego means that we must rid ourselves of judgment as well. Non-Judgment Day is Coming. Are You Ready? Essentially exposes judgment, what it is, why we make judgments, the pain and suffering it causes, and how to eliminate judgment of yourself and others. And the fourth book is titled 14 Inches to Peace, because that's as far as we have to journey to get out of our heads and into our hearts to discover and enjoy our true spiritual essence. And the first half of the book is a 7-step experiential approach to help you travel from your head to your heart, where spirit can be integrated into your daily life. The second half of the book is based on the fact that many people who participate in the Awakened Ego Perspective tell us that it is profound, has a profound deepening effect on their existing spiritual practices. And to demonstrate this point, I and co-author Elizabeth Bow, who has for many years facilitated A Course in Miracles, framed 55 questions and then answered them both from the Awakened Ego and A Course in Miracles perspectives to show that Awakened Ego is a powerful entry point to deepen one's journey into A Course in Miracles and more than likely into most other spiritual practices as well. So there in a nutshell, Steve, you have the 4 books.
What would you recommend is the best order in which we read your books? And is there one that is best to read first?
Well, each of them can be an entry point into the Awakened Ego Perspective. Again, they are different views of the same mountain. For those who are looking for an overview of my work, I suppose Beyond the Ego being the primer would probably best help you achieve that.
So tell us about this Awakened Ego program.
I'd be happy to. Ego, of course, is Latin for I. So Awakened Ego means quite literally awakened I. Or more specifically, awakened ego means awakened to who I think I am and who you think you are. You see, who you think you are is both a conscious and an unconscious component. You might think of yourself, for example, as being a student, a mother, a chemist, a radio broadcaster. These are all conscious definitions. Unconsciously, that which we're not aware of is a very different thing. We're unaware of the much larger part of who we think we are as beings. Though we are all one, our early childhood experience teaches us that we are not all one, but rather that we are separate entities in the world. And this is the basis of who unconsciously we think we are, separate beings, each of us struggling in our attempts to ensure our own survival. In other words, from early childhood, each of us harbors the unconscious belief that I am a separate being, but we are not separate beings. We are all one. And therefore, any attempt to think and behave like someone we're not can only lead to pain. That is emotional pain. We feel afraid, alone, disconnected, unimportant, and insecure, and so on. Yet in our earliest and most formative years, we keep living and we keep breathing. An ego, who you think you are, a separate entity in the world, concludes that since I survive while hurting emotionally, I must continue to hurt emotionally in order to survive. Let me say that again. It's so foundational to the Awakened Eagle program that it bears repeating. Since I survive while hurting, I must continue to hurt in order to survive. So you see, this conclusion by ego becomes the unconscious driver in our adult lives. Ego keeps leading us to some form of dissatisfaction and suffering to affirm its own survival until we become aware of this dynamic at work. To do that, we must experience the relationship between ego and spirit directly in order to find out where and how it lives inside us, and then gently and lovingly take steps to rid ourselves of it. But the key here, Steve, is that you aren't just told to go out on your own and try to experience ego directly, to try to embrace it, to try and experience its shrinking, and to try to experience the peace that flows into your heart as a result. Nor are you merely told that this is what you must do. No. These are the things that you actually experience in the Awakened Ego Workshop. Once you experience it, you own it, and you carry it forward.
Why do you suppose, David, the Awakened Ego program grew so quickly and has been so successful?
Well, it offers a refreshing new perspective. People are hungry for it. They're ready for it. They've tried this or that spiritual approach, often many different practices over many years. But all too often, they still hurt. They still don't experience the lasting peace that they seek, just as was true for me.
Well, let's focus on this new dimension of spirituality and the Awaken to Ego program, this catalyst, as you put it, for spiritual transformation.
You know, we often hear students say, this program is it. This is what I've been looking for all these years. So perhaps the best way I can answer your question is to read a small sampling of what people say it is once they've gone through the program. So let me read for just a minute here. It is a thread that weaves through the truths of other spiritual traditions and ties them all together. It is the spiritual fountain of youth. It is a personalized, simple way of finding your true self by getting rid of the pain that ego has caused in your life. It is an experiential, clear, and very thorough revelation of ego in general, and most importantly, my own. It is life-changing, an experiential framework for understanding the world and a structure on which to build one's life. It is a non-intellectual means for obtaining spiritual fulfillment without cluttering the head with more and more information. And it is a life-transforming experience. Once you've been through it, it is impossible to return to a life driven by ego. And so I hope these few examples give you the flavor of what is unique about the Awakened Ego program.
Specifically, David, then, how does one benefit from your perspective that they may not find in other spiritual approaches?
Well, first, so much about spirituality is esoteric and mysterious, which can make it difficult to comprehend or apply. The Awakened Ego perspective brings the subject of spirituality down to earth in language that is straightforward and uncomplicated. The second benefit is that it moves your spiritual beliefs into your heart, which in turn empowers you to change your life. Third, eight helps you gain, as eight is an acronym for Awakened Ego, helps you gain an understanding of what ego is and specifically how it operates inside you to cause you acute or chronic emotional pain. The fourth benefit, once you learn to identify the presence of ego in yourself, you then learn the one simple practice to rid yourself of it. The fifth, this approach makes sense and it works. Most spiritual approaches make sense, but they don't all work. And sixth, the books and workshops help all people who participate, regardless of their spiritual orientation or beliefs, including beginners and those who have been on spiritual journeys for many years.
Does one need to attend an Awakened Ego weekend intensive workshop to experience these benefits you've just discussed, or can a person get this from your books?
Oh, well, Steve, we have many reports from readers who have made significant changes in their lives from reading the books, changing undesirable behavior patterns, improvement in their close relationships, a greater sense of peace, and an understanding of human behavior from an entirely new perspective, but they feel much more compassion for others who they may have previously judged. So I would say unequivocally that there is much value in reading one or more of the books. But that said, people who attend the Awaken the Ego Intensive workshop tell us that as much as they found the books easy to understand, as much as it brought valuable changes to their lives, they also share openly that participating in the Awaken the Ego workshop brings it home, as the saying goes, that it deepens what they've read, makes it more personal, takes it to a depth they've never dreamed possible, that it brings their spirituality to life.
So what do you cover in this weekend intensive training, this program?
Well, lots of things, but briefly, you are introduced to a powerful new approach that unlocks the deeper reaches of your own spiritual practices. You experience directly the power of your spirit to rid yourself of ego and its painful influence. You discover your life map and the huge role it plays to perpetuate ego's negative energy. You develop the tools to apply what we call the one simple practice to rid yourself of ego. And you learn not only what to do, but even more importantly, you experience that which is so often missing from your spiritual programs, as I said, and that is how to do it, so you can sustain your journey to happiness and peace.
Finally, David, how does a person purchase your books, and how do interested persons register to attend one of your weekend intensives?
Well, you can do both by going to my website, which is drdavidmuscler.com. That's without a period, drdavidmuscler.com. You select the book or books you wish to purchase. That will take you directly to where you place the order at Balboa Press, and you'll receive it in only a few days. To attend the weekend Awaken Ego weekend workshop, click on events and then follow your prompts to sign up for the location where you'd like to attend. Gosh, Steve, I see we're about out of time, so let me say thank you for inviting me to be on your program, and many blessings to each of you who have taken the time to listen.
Well, very interesting, Dr. Mutchler. It certainly seems clear that a growing number of people find your books and seminars, obviously, to be very beneficial. Thank you as well for joining us today, and we hope that more and more people take advantage of the ways your work can help them. So thank you very much for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.